you with your personal computing.
Progressive Radio Network is now on iTunes. Search for us to listen and download past shows or get them updated automatically. Just type Progressive Radio Network in the search bar and download any show free of charge. Progressive Radio Network, information for the independent mind.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City, and I'd like to welcome you. We're going to begin, as we always do, with the latest on health and healing and how to slow down and, wherever possible, reverse the aging process. You're going to learn how dancing can reverse aging in the brain, even more than intensive exercising. And then a new study shows how the smartphone reduces brain power, even when it's off. And then there's a groundbreaking study showing fasting can slow the aging process and rebuild your immune system. This is from the University of Southern California. And also some compounds in cacao or chocolate can help delay onset of type 2 diabetes and much more on health and healing. Then it's commentary day, a powerful commentary on Antifa mirrors the alt-right, Chris Hedges. Then a Harvey didn't come out of the blue, now it is the time to talk about climate change, Naomi Klein. And extreme storms like Harvey and climate change, this is the new reality. I've written my own commentary I'll be sharing with you today. And my question is this. If we care about tearing down monuments to racism, discrimination, any form of genocide, shouldn't we first take an honest look at the most massive institutional edifice for racism, and that's the prison system. We have more people incarcerated than any other country in the world, and that includes some really bad regimes like in China or repressive ones in Russia. And yet we have the most. Over 2.4 million Americans at any given time are in our prisons. But we have over 7 million who've been in prisons. Now, multiply that times 4 in the average family, and you're up to 28 million people have been directly impacted by incarceration. And yet study after study shows they're not working. They're not a deterrent from crime. People are still going to commit crimes. So what is the answer? Well, by one estimate, over 50% of all the people in prison shouldn't be there. And why shouldn't they be there? Because of our laws that have made things that historically would not have been a crime, should not be a crime based on any moral or violent code. They're simply non-aggressive, non-violent choices people make, like to use marijuana. So someone should rot in prison, have their life destroyed because they did something that at one time was legal, and yet no one dies from using marijuana, and a lot of people's lives could be saved from medicinal use of marijuana. Yet a lot of people die from drinking. Lives are destroyed by drinking and alcohol and smoking. Far more people have died from the effects of cigarette smoke, over 20 million that we know of, and that's probably a low count over the decades. And yet we allow people the freedom of choice. Now think how many people die each year from obesity, heart disease, high blood pressure, and stroke, and suffer and die from dementia, all because of choices, bad choices, it turns out, but at least the freedom of choice. So should we ban everything that's bad for us? Should we then make it a federal crime? Should we put people in prison? Why the hypocrisy? Why some things are considered actionable to put you in prison, but others are not? So I believe we should honestly look at taking our entire justice system apart. Our judiciary is fraudulent. It is biased. Our body politic is completely corrupt. Any reasonable person could understand that. It's been bought a long time ago. I've had the advantage of being on non-commercial radio in Washington, D.C. for over 34 years, 5 days a week. Many, many trips there, lots of lectures, lots of fundraisers, premieres. The last one at George Washington University. No, the last one was, that was filled, 1,300 people. The last one before that was far more people at a civic center. So I've had a chance to speak with people who work, live within that whole beltway complex. And they tell me personally that every single part of the system is biased. It's not meant to serve the public interest. It's meant to serve the corporate interest. Why can't we acknowledge that and simply stop it? So here's my question of the day. This is our talkback question. If we're going to challenge all monuments, and we shouldn't be biased, we should simply say, if a monument represents something that should be a lesson learned to all people today, and especially younger people will not know these lessons, from the people on Mount Rushmore to the White House to Congress, those are institutions that were built using slave labor. Should we honor them by continuing, or should we close them up and let them be museums and then have what I would consider something very positive, honest historical reviews that you could go in and have thousands and thousands of hours of looking into the background of laws that were passed that should not have been, people who held seats who should never have been in Congress, how different groups at different times were war parties, others were against the Native Americans. Shouldn't we look honestly at all the Native American tribes and what land today no longer belongs to them but did, and what institutions have been built based upon that genocide? I believe it's time for us to write an honest history of the United States, stream it online, but have it at these institutions. But we should be closing down the prison system, the jail system. We should completely gut the entire penal code. We have millions of laws. We don't need any more laws. We have 1,000 times more laws than what we need. This is all a stupid game we're playing. We don't need lawmakers. They're not interested in what our needs are. They're interested in ALEC at the state level. All these state capitals are corrupted by the American Legislative Exchange Council, representing 200 to 300 major corporations, working on passing over 25,000 laws, and you never knew of one of them. No media covered one of them. Every year they're meeting in private and deciding, here's how we want you to present this bill. We've written the bill for you. You're going to benefit from it because we're going to fund your campaign. You're going to have consulting work after you get out of this office. So do our bidding. Not one single person was ever embarrassed, exposed, or recalled because of the corruption, collusion between corporate interest and state legislation. And it's worse at the federal level. And it's also true at the state level or the local level. So shouldn't we just stop long enough to take an honest look at how fetid, morbid, and disingenuous we have become as a society? Just a thought. Talk back. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Your turn in about 20 minutes. I want to give that to you up front. Now, I have a guest in the second part of our program today who is really interesting. He is Dr. John McDougall. He'll be talking from Santa Rosa, California. And we're going to talk about how a nutritional, plant-based diet can prevent and, more importantly, reverse diseases. So you hear Dr. McDougall talk about the diseases he's personally been able to reverse in people. And he's not using the mainstream medical model any longer. So how's he do it? We'll talk with him. So let's begin. I'm going to be having a dance party. We're just trying to close today a contract for a nice venue, one I've never used before. I had one of my staff go and look at it last night and said it's nice to have a nice dance floor. I'll provide my own DJ and mix the music, but we'll do it next week if all goes well, and I'll announce it tomorrow. And it'll be free to you. It's my way of saying thank you for supporting this program and also for your patience in supporting our local sister station, BAI, through all of its problems in getting premiums in a timely manner at all and still continuing to support it. So it's your time to celebrate, to dance, to socialize, young, old, men, women, couples. It'll be one of the rare occasions where you can go and not have drugs and smoking and alcohol, just positive people sharing nice rhythm. Okay? I'll announce tomorrow if we've signed the contract, so we're in. In any case, here is something that's a study, and this is from the Center for Neurodegenerative Disease out of Germany, and here's what it says. Quote, comparing two different fitness routines shows that both can have an anti-aging effect on the brain in the elderly, but only dancing gives rise to a measurable difference in behavior. And in this condition, it was Alzheimer's. It really made a difference. And this was published in Frontiers in Human Neuroscience. And it shows that when you're over the age of 60, people who routinely partake in physical exercise can reverse the signs of aging in the brain, and dancing has the most profound effect. So, for those who think that you shouldn't be dancing because you're too old, just the opposite. You should be dancing because you're getting old. It can help keep your brain younger. And also, the antioxidants in our diet help keep the risk of death lower. And there was a university in Spain that did a study that showed that antioxidants make a big difference. And there were 19,000 participants in this called the Sun Project. And here's my thoughts. We have an attack upon our cells, our DNA, every microsecond of every day of our lives. Now, if you're making healthy choices, eating a clean diet, drinking clean water, exercising, dealing with stress, having quality relationships, living in a clean environment, you can minimize those to, I'm guesstimating, around 1,000 gene alterations per day. All right. That means you're going to age substantially slower than the average person. But if you're the average person and you eat the average diet and you don't pay attention to the environment you're working in, the quality of the work, as long as it's paying your bills, you think it's okay, well, you know, I'll just bear with it until I have to retire. And then I'll enjoy my life. Big mistake. And maybe the relationship isn't the best relationship. Maybe it's lost its magic. Maybe it never had it. But it gives me a better sense of security than being alone. Can't handle the aloneness. Well, you pay a big price for that. So the choices we make and justify end up causing us stress. Stress is a pro-inflammatory oxidative stress contributor, meaning it causes up to 10,000 gene alterations per day. Every 24 hours, you're having an alteration in your DNA, every single DNA in your body, and it's up to 10,000. Well, that's what causes us to age and get disease. So if we reduce those by making healthier choices, you can reasonably expect to live another 20 years in good health. Or you die 20 years sooner than what you should in poor health. So there's tremendous consequence to this whole thing. And the antioxidants are one of the things that you can put health on your side. Vitamin C, vitamin E, vitamin D3, tocotrienols, L-cysteine, methionine, glutathione. All of these are important for good health. But we have to take them each day. Now, if you had to narrow it down and say, okay, Gary, I can only afford three. What three should I take? Because the free radicals that cause oxidative stress and pain, inflammation, Once they come in the presence of an antioxidant, the antioxidant attaches to it and neutralizes the free radical. So then it's which antioxidants can loop the most times through your body. Here are the three that are most powerful in slowing down and reversing the aging process. Those three would be vitamin C, alpha-lipoic acid, and vitamin E with tocotrienols. Those are your three superstars. If you did just those three, alpha-lipoic acid, 2 to 600 milligrams a day, vitamin C, 2 to 10,000 milligrams a day, and vitamin E, 800 units, 400 in the morning, 400 in the afternoon, you're doing yourself a lot of good. Now, mind you, there are a lot more that we should be taking antioxidants, but these literally can eliminate a lot and slow down a lot of the attacks against your cells. Now, for those of you who are eating a lot of salt on your food, and most people are, that's not good. If you want something that tastes salty, simply in a little dispenser with a little spritzer on it, much like you could spray alcohol on surfaces, put lemon juice. Or if you want something a little more exotic, put lemon, cayenne, a pinch of cayenne, mint, and lime. And then you put that into a spritzer. And now when you spritz that on a salad, it gives you a wonderful taste. And the mouth actually thinks you're tasting salt. So it satisfies your craving for salt. I make potatoes and I spray lemon juice on the potato. And it gives that salty quality, but it's all good. The lemon is one of nature's really great healing fruits. But here's what happens if you do it the wrong way. If you start eating the French fries and the meat and all the food with high sodium, which most has. And this is from the National Institute for Health and Welfare in Finland. And it says, high salt intake associated with doubling the risk of heart failure. Quote, high salt intake is associated with the double risk of heart failure. This is a 12-year study on 4,000 people. And, quote, high sodium, which is sodium chloride, intake is one of the major causes of high blood pressure and an independent risk factor for coronary heart disease and stroke. So there's no question that the sodium that we're eating is far more than what we need. In fact, I did a simple analysis. I went to some fast food restaurants. I then went to some restaurants that don't just serve burgers but serve meals, but you see them advertised all the time. The food is, you know, the big piece of meat or the shrimp or the fish, whatever it is. And I looked at the amount of sodium in the average person's meal. This did not include the amount of salt they put on with salt shakers. And you see this all the time. People get something and they immediately start putting salt on it without even tasting it. And so manufacturers then start realizing people have this desire for salt. So they put salt in everything, like they put sugar in everything. Well, the average person at the restaurants I checked is over 5,000 milligrams a day. How much do you need? You only need 800 milligrams. So if you're getting 500% more sodium than what you need, you're really putting yourself at risk of high blood pressure. Now, this was good. This is from George Washington University and Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. Vegetarian diet linked with lower cholesterol reaffirms its power. And once again, they took a look at a very important factor in our diet, and that is how much vegetables and fruits and grains and nuts and seeds we're eating. And they found that if you have, quote, a plant-based vegetarian diet, especially vegan diets, think of all the people out there who are doing it right, are associated with lower total cholesterol and lower the bad cholesterol. And this was published in Nutrition Reviews. So those of you who are still are on a omnivorous diet, following a vegetarian diet, was associated with significant improvement. And by the way, when you have the wrong blood fat markers, triglycerides elevated, cholesterol elevated, you're more likely to have a heart attack. And finally, this was an interesting study from the Karolinska Institute in Sweden. And it follows something I discussed yesterday about why you want to make sure your telomeres are healthy, because the telomeres are the end caps of chromosomes that protect your DNA. And so if you want to protect your DNA from any form of contamination or aging, inflammation, you got to make sure that you're doing the right thing. And here's what this study showed. Is telomere length associated with the cognitive response to a lifestyle intervention? This was a new study. And they found that people who had shorter telomeres, because they were not having a healthy diet, once they shifted over to a healthy diet, they got lengthening of the telomeres by measure in their lymphocytes. So the good news is that even if you have not been doing everything that you should to be healthy, you can reclaim your health and get your telomeres working on your behalf, getting them protecting the cells if you switch over to a healthy diet and also exercise. So that's good to know. And that's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Knoll, back in a moment. Please stay with us. Tonight at 7 o'clock, I've got a dual action going on. I'm going to be premiering for the worldwide audience, and we've just expanded our bandwidth because we were packed again for Plant Codes. Plant Codes is a very powerful, very upbeat, feel-good documentary about what happens to people when they shift to a plant-based diet. And so if you haven't seen it, you can go to GaryKnoll.com, and you can. It'll be at 7 o'clock. But also at 7 o'clock, I'm going to be doing the progressive commentary on a very important subject and with one of our conversations with the Remarkable Minds. I'm doing both simultaneously because after doing my introduction to the film, then the film is a little over an hour, so I'll then shift over. So I've seen the film. I don't have to watch it again, having directed and written it. So while you're all watching it, I'll be doing progressive commentary. Then right after that, 8 o'clock, I'll be coming back over and then doing about an hour and a half or so of answering your questions on the issues involving the changeover from a plant-based diet. So it'll be a fun evening. What would happen if today we had Martin Luther King as one example? There are many other examples, but just let's use him. Because for many of us, he was not just a hero, but he taught us how to face oppression. He taught us what to say in the face of power that had removed itself from any moral equation when it came to how they treated us or people around the world. So when Martin Luther King was speaking, he was speaking for the innocent civilians killed in Vietnam and damaged in Vietnam and all the wars of aggression that we'd engaged in. He was not just speaking on behalf of the African Americans in the United States. His truths were universal truths. So when he sought to address crimes against humanity, it may have been said locally, but it was something to be heard universally. So today in the United States, we are polarized. We are polarized by our neglect, our indifference, our self-absorbed interest and identity politics. The vast majority of people have not defined themselves by a living legacy, meaning they are not looking, what can I as an individual do to make it a better world, not just for myself, but for my community, for my neighbors, for the citizens of the world? What can I do to keep our rivers clean, our skies clean, our food clean, and honor the commons, that which all of us should be able to enjoy, that shouldn't be privatized, that shouldn't be commodified? What can I do to protest the violence in our world, in our society, by police forces being militarized, by SWAT teams? What can I do? And then what can we do together? And then what can the many of us do together? I believe there would be no better person to tell us how to do that because he did. And if he were alive today, he would have been protesting all the things. He'd be out there talking about at what point will we learn that we must prevent the conditions that manifest, prevent wars by not invading countries, not occupying countries, not setting up 900 military bases in other people's countries, not by corrupting those systems in order to exploit other people's resources and then wonder why they get angry with us. He would be the first to tell you that. He would also be the first to tell you, why are you living on the ocean? You've just gotten flooded. It's going to be in the tens of billions, if not hundreds of billions, dollars in damage. We've never seen flooding like this in American history. And yet this is the second mega flood to happen in Texas in the last 12 months. The second mega flood to happen in Louisiana in the last 12 months. These are supposed to be biblical, once in every 500 years. And now we have two of them in two states. We had in Wisconsin, Virginia. Now, what's it say about San Francisco, Los Angeles, New York City, the whole Delaware area, Washington, D.C., Miami, Fort Lauderdale, the Keys? All of these are going to be affected. It is inevitable. It's not, are they going to be hit? It's when and to what degree. Now, the storm you're now seeing right now as I'm speaking, that will now become the new norm. It will not be unusual to see two or three of those at that level every year. So would you go back and build in the same place? Would you watch people suffering, dying, losing everything, and say, maybe it's time that we rethought where we live? Well, good luck trying to get anyone in America to learn a lesson from their disaster. If we learn from our disasters, we wouldn't have another bubble. We wouldn't have credit card bubbles. We wouldn't have income inequality. We wouldn't have a massive surveillance state. We wouldn't have a corruption in every single one of our institutions. We wouldn't have it. We would have learned the lesson. We would not be voting for Trump. Why do you think at the end of the day, the only reason Donald Trump got elected is because the failure of the Democrats of not honoring any of their promises outside of when they were on the campaign trail and telling people they're going to do all this stuff for him, then went back to Washington, just the opposite. If we had anyone who really cared about honoring the populace, truly bringing jobs back to America, restoring our infrastructure, giving us a living wage, not just a minimum wage, and having universal health care, then who would have voted for Trump?
I don't think of love as, in this context, as emotional bosh. I don't think of it as a weak force. But I think of love as something strong and that organizes itself into powerful direct action. Now, this is what I tried to teach in the struggle in the South, that we are not engaged in a struggle that means we sit down and do nothing. That there's a great deal of difference between non-resistance to evil and non-violent resistance. Non-resistance leaves you in a state of stagnant passivity and deadened complacency, wherein non-violent resistance means that you do resist in a very strong and determined manner. Non-violence, organized non-violent resistance is the most powerful weapon that oppressed people can use in breaking loose from the bondage of oppression. Now, the other method that one might use is that of resignation or acquiescence. But I think that is just as bad as violence, because non-cooperation with evil is as much a moral obligation as is cooperation with good.
You make a difference, a distinction between passive resistance and non-violent resistance, is that it?
Well, I think that can be something of a semantical problem. If passive resistance means just passively accepting violence or injustice, if it means cowardice and stagnant passivity, then there is a difference, because nonviolent resistance does resist. It is dynamically active. It is passive physically, but it is strongly active spiritually.
Those are just a few of the, from two different talks he gave, of how Martin Luther King would be approaching social change, political change, nonviolent in his methods, but powerful because we remember, and many people live by what he shared with us, as we do with Gandhi and others before them. I'm very disappointed in how many people on the left have been embracing the Antifa, the people dressed in black, carrying clubs and baseball bats and, in effect, weapons, not to protest, which is their right, and to protest nonviolently to show their concern about those that they consider or believe or avowed racist, but instead engaging in violence, engaging in a stopping of free speech, engaging in free assembly. If I don't like what someone has to say, I'll invite them on this program to debate me, as I have many times. But I do not believe that I or anyone else should say, you have no right to assemble, you have no right to your speech, even if it's hate speech. I may deplore what a person says, but I must also understand that the moment we open that door and say, in my self-righteousness, I dictate what is acceptable. Anything it's not should not be tolerated at any level. And then you keep someone from assembling, from speaking in colleges or on the street. You realize where that's going to lead, don't you? Let us think for a moment on this. Behind the rhetoric of the alt-right, according to Chris Hedges, and I know many of you in this audience have shared the thoughts with me, including someone last night when I was on the street and walking, we had this conversation, that the rally organized by the right-wing group turned violent this Sunday after arrival of a group that carried an anarchist banner. Behind the rhetoric of the alt-right about white nativism and protecting American traditions, history, and Christian values is the lust for violence. Behind the rhetoric of the Antifa, the black bloc, and the so-called alt-left against capitalism and racism and state repression and corporate power is the same lust for violence. The two opposing groups, largely made up of people who have been cast aside by the cruelty of corporate capitalism, have embraced a holy war. Their lives, battered by economic misery and social marginalization, have suddenly been filled with meaning. They hold themselves up as the vanguard of the oppressed. They aggregate to themselves the right to use force to silence those they define as the enemy. They sanctify anger. They are infected with the dark, adrenaline-driven urge for confrontation that arises among the disenfranchised when a democracy ceases to function. They are separated, as Sigmund Freud wrote, of those who engage in this type of conflict by a narcissism of minor differences. They mirror each other, not only ideologically, but also physically, armed and dressed in black, the color of fascism and the color of death. It was inevitable that we would reach this point. The corporate state has seized and corrupted all democratic institutions, including the two main political parties, in their entirety, to serve the interests of corporate power and maximize global corporate profits. There is no justice in the courts. There is no possibility for reform in the legislative bodies. The executive branch is a dysfunctional mess headed by a narcissist, kleptocrat, con artist, and pathological liar. Money has replaced the vote. The consent of the governed is a joke. Our most basic constitutional rights, including the right to privacy and due process, have been taken from us by the judicial fiat. the economically marginalized, now a majority of the country, have been rendered invisible by a corporate media dominated by highly paid courtiers, spewing out meaningless political and celebrity gossip and trivia as if it were news. The corporate state, unimpeded, is pillaging and looting the carcass of the country and the government along with the natural world for the personal gain of the 1%. It daily locks away in cages the poor, especially poor people of color, discarding the vulnerable as human refuge. A government that is paralyzed, unable and unwilling to address the rudimentary needs of its citizens. That's what we're dealing with. Germany's Nazi stormtroopers had their counterparts in that nation's communist alliance of Red Front fighters. The far-right anti-communist death squad alliance of Argentina had its counterpart in the guerrilla group, the People's Revolutionary Army, during the Dirty War. They are all one against the other. The violence of the Antifa, short for anti-fascist or anti-fascist action, in Charlotte, saw a surge in interest and support for the movement, especially after the murder of Heather Ahare. The Black Bloc was applauded by some of the counter-protesters in Boston during an alt-right rally there. The white racist neo-Nazis, they're unsavory, absolutely. But did you ever consider what Chris Hedges feels? Quote, they are victims. They too lost jobs and often live in poverty and deindustrialized wastelands. They too often are plagued by debt, foreclosures, bank repossessions, and inability to repay student loans. They too often suffer from evictions, opiate addictions, domestic violence, and despair. They too sometimes face bankruptcy because of medical bills. They too have been seen social services gutted, public education degraded and privatized, and the infrastructure around them decay. They too often suffer from police abuse and mass incarceration. They too are often in despair and suffer from homelessness. They too have the right to speech, however repugnant and repulsive their views may be. Here is a thought. If you go into every single poor community in America, how many people in those communities are feared because of how they choose now to survive and how they make their money? And what would be different if we brought jobs and health care and made that once again as it once was in Camden or Detroit or Newark or Compton, a living community, a viable community with family outreach support? Would they be different, those that we have incarcerated, those who have dealt in inflicting pain upon others? Shouldn't we at least take a moment to see what is the underlying basis for a person's actions, no matter how revolting those actions are? But we choose not to. We keep it short and quick without thinking. And as a result, these clashes divide the underclass. They divert activists from threatening the actual structures of power. They give the corporate state the ammunition to impose harsher forms of control and expand the powers of internal security. And when these anti-fascists assume the right to curtail free speech, it becomes a weapon in the hands of its enemies to take that freedom away from everyone, especially the anti-capitalist. The focus on streets violence diverts activists from the far less glamorous building of relationships and alternative institutions and community organizing that alone will make effective resistance possible. We will defeat the corporate state only, I repeat, only when we take back and empower our communities, as is happening with cooperation in grassroots cooperative movements from Jackson, Mississippi to other communities. As long as acts of resistance are forms of personal catharsis, the corporate state is secure. Indeed, the corporate state welcomes this violence. They welcome violence because it is the language they can speak with a proficiency and ruthlessness that none are able to match. Politics isn't made of individuals. Sophia Burns writes in Catharsis is Counter-Revolutionary. She says, it's made of classes. Political change doesn't come from feeling individually validated. It comes from collective action and organizing within the working class. That means creating new institutions that meet authentic needs and defend against oppression. The protests of the radical left, now swelling America, and as Chomsky points out, are too often little more than self-advertisements for moral purity. They are products of a social media culture in which each of us is the star of our own life movie. They're infected with the American belief in regeneration through violence and the cult of the gun. They represent a clash between the bankruptcy of identity politics, which produced, as Dr. Cornel West has said, a president who was, quote, a black mascot for Wall Street, and the bankruptcy of a white, Christianized fascism that produced Donald Trump and Stephen Bannon and Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Rather than organizing for change, individuals seek to enact a statement about their own righteousness, Chomsky writes, and how not to challenge racist violence. Quote from Chomsky, they may boycott certain products, refuse to eat certain foods, or they may show up to marches or rallies whose only purpose is to demonstrate the moral superiority of the participants. White people may loudly claim that they recognize their privilege or declare themselves allies of people of color or other marginalized groups. People may declare their communities no place for hate, or they may show up as countermarches to stand up to white nationalism and neo-Nazis. All these types of activism emphasize self-improvement or self-expression rather than seeking concrete change in society or policy. They are deeply and deliberately apolitical in the sense that they do not seek to address issues of power and resources and decision-making or how to bring about change, end quote. In conclusion, the corporate state seeks to discredit and shut down the anti-capitalist left. Its natural allies are the neo-Nazis and the Christian fascists. The alt-right is bankrolled, after all, by the most retrograde forces in American capitalism. It has huge media platforms. It has placed its ideologies and sympathizers in positions of power, including in law enforcement and the military. And it has carried out acts of domestic terrorism that dwarf anything carried out by the left. White supremacists were responsible for the 49 homicides and 26 attacks in the United States between 2006 and 16. And those committed by members of any other extremist group were secondary, according to a report. There's no moral equivalency between the anti-fascists and the alt-right fascists. But by brawling in the street, the anti-fascists allow the corporate state, which is terrified of a popular anti-capitalist uprising, to use the false argument of moral equivalency to criminalize the work of the anti-capitalist. I'm Gary Knoll. Let us now go over and say hello to my guest who is standing by, Dr. John McDougall. He is a nationally renowned medical internist and nutrition expert who has treated thousands of patients with whole food, plant-based dietary protocols and lifestyle changes over the last 30 years. And he's founder of the McDougall Program, which is an intensive residential health program held in Santa Rosa, California. He's the author of many books, including the McDougall Digestive Tune-Up and the McDougall Program, and his website is drmcdougall.com. Nice to have you with us today.
Well, thank you, Gary. It's been a long time since we've been together. In fact, you were out at our program, what, about 2-3 years ago?
Yes, the Continuing Education for Medical Doctors program.
And no question about it. You left an impression. People still talk about you. You did a great job.
Well, thank you. Today, I'd like, if you would please, to share with us what you have personally experienced with patients that you have reversed their disease, helped them cure conditions that, for all intents and purposes, most mainstream medicine would say, okay, we can treat the disease, but we can't reverse it. We can only handle some of the symptoms with these meds. Take us through some of the diseases and the protocols that you have offered people.
Well, I'm a board-certified internist. In other words, I'm just a regular doctor, general doctor, and I've been doing this for a half a century. I've been doing dietary therapy, basically changing people's diets for four decades, for 40 years. And not only have I found it, many other people have found the same thing, like Nathan Pritikin, and I know you found similar things, Gary Null, but we published seven papers that talk about 2,500 of the probably 10,000 patients I've seen. And they've had problems from obesity to constipation to heart disease. We just published a study on multiple sclerosis and diet, many autoimmune diseases. In fact, you and I have had a relationship about autoimmune diseases and trying to help people. It's basically the problem is people are being poisoned by food. And the two categories of food poisoning are animal foods and vegetable oils. You know, just to make it easier for people, like if they want to quit smoking, they only have to do one thing, and that's stop putting those tubes of tobacco in their mouth. When you want to change your diet, you want to make it as simple as possible. So the two categories of food poison are animal foods. That means snake eyes and pig's ears and, you know, whale milk and whatever. They're not good for the human being. They put a burden that I can only call poisoning on the body. And vegetable oil does the same thing. That's like corn oil, safflower oil, olive oil, and so on. It's too big of a burden. Least makes people fat. And some forms of vegetable oil gives them heart disease. Some forms will prevent heart disease, but all of them are fattening. So what do you eat if you can't eat animal foods and oil? Well, the diet that I started, which actually I didn't start it. I started in my practice. The diet that I started 40 years ago, I learned when I was a sugar plantation doctor in Hawaii. I was taking care of 5,000 Filipinos, Japanese, Chinese, Koreans, and I found that my first generation, those who lived on 90% rice, no dairy, very little animal foods, they never got overweight. They worked into their 90s, never had multiple sclerosis, rheumatoid arthritis, never had heart attacks. These are really healthy people that I was taking care of, but I also took care of their children and grandchildren. So the second and third generation, when we were living in Hawaii on the sugar plantation, they switched over to Texas Drive-In and McDonald's and Burger King. And now in Hawaii, the people of this generation are some of the fattest, most cancerous, sickest people in the world. So what I discovered then is the problem was too much rich food was killing people. It was making them look and suffer like kings and queens. And the solution was to feed them the human diet, which is based on starch like rice, corn, potatoes, sweet potatoes with some fruits and vegetables. And you minimize your animal food intake, like maybe turkey Thanksgiving or maybe a piece of birthday cake on your birthday. But you can't have these celebrations every day. So I started taking people off celebratory food and putting them on a diet of pasta and oatmeal and pizzas and mushu vegetables and rice and all kinds of healthy foods. And they get to eat as much as they want. We reported in the scientific literature benefits for multiple sclerosis, relief of fatigue, a 22-point drop in cholesterol in 7 days, which lasts a year, a 3.1-pound weight loss on average, eating as much as you want, which turns into 20 pounds in a year. Our work has been studied by Oregon Health and Science University, which is the medical school in Portland. So this is unbiased evaluation.
Give us an example, then, of some of the more advanced cases that if they had not gone on your program, they would have died, and how you, what you did. What was the outcome?
Well, you know, that's making a prediction that I can't really do, which is when somebody's going to die. But I think I've given them information that helped them live longer, and certainly I know better. I take care of a lot of people who have heart disease. They're ready to go for catheterizations or bypass surgeries, and almost always we stop their chest pain. And based on some data of mine and data of other people's, we actually reverse some of the diseased arteries. Type 2 diabetes, I take care of lots of type 2 diabetics. In fact, probably, no, certainly hundreds every year. And type 2 diabetes, where people are sometimes taking insulin, usually taking pills, we get everybody off their medication, and everybody gets to have a normal blood sugar as they follow the diet and lose the weight. Now, any weight loss program will cause this to happen, but ours just happens to be easier and more permanent. Type 1 diabetes, they stay on insulin, but, you know, they get to see and have their kidneys work and have a good life by not poisoning themselves with animal foods and oils. We do take care of some cancers once in a while. I can't do a lot of bragging about that because we haven't collected data. But the American Heart Association, they published their guidelines in 2015, I meant the American Cancer Society published their recommendations in February 2015. The American Cancer Society officially told doctors that when patients have cancers, including melanoma, colon cancer, breast cancer, and prostate cancer, that if they change their diet, they will live longer. And that's what the American Cancer Society says. That's what I believed my whole career. I believe I published the first study ever published on that, on breast cancer in 1984. So, yeah, we take care of cancer patients, and I would have to say I know they get better in quality. I would have to guess they get a more quantity of life, too. So we take care of MS patients as part of our multiple sclerosis, part of our official program. We've got research published on it and, you know, all kinds of things. So we take care of a lot of problems, all the way from people who are triathlon winners and just want to go a little faster to people who can barely get the wheelchair going.
How do you do with inflammatory conditions like arthritis, bursitis, fibromyalgia?
Well, I would say, you know, if I had to take a guess that I could justify, probably 100% success in terms of benefit. Some people, you know, they have so much damage to their joints and their bursas that no matter what you do, they just have permanent damage. You can't reverse that. But when it comes to inflammatory autoimmune diseases, our success rate is very high. I published 10 studies in May 2014 in my newsletter of people with severe psoriatic, nonspecific rheumatoid arthritis, all essentially cures. And it's been my experience, and again, I've been doing this for 4 years. We actually published a study on it about 25 years ago. But it's been my experience that people with rheumatoid arthritis and lupus, et cetera, when they stop the cause, which is the Western diet, they get better, dramatically better, but they probably will be left with some residual disease. But the inflammation stops because you stop the cause of the inflammation, which is injury from the food.
What about high blood pressure, the number two killer after heart disease?
Well, we have published results on high blood pressure from several studies. The one I would like to talk about, we published in 2014 in the Nutrition Journal. It was on 1,615 people. And those people had started with high blood pressure, and they were usually on medication. The definition would be 160 over 90 millimeters of mercury. Of those who started on medication, or who are on medication, had a blood pressure of 160 over 90 or greater, the average drop in blood pressure in 17 was 18 over 11 millimeters of mercury. But what you don't hear in that statement is that we have documented, we're talking about 1,600 people, we have documented that nearly 90% of them reduce or stop their blood pressure medication, along with getting those phenomenal drops in pressures.
We have an epidemic of obesity in the United States today. We're the fattest nation on earth per population. That says something when you consider the population of India, the population of China at approximately 1.35 billion per country. We're a little country of 330 million compared to 2.6 billion. And yet per population, we have more obese children. We have more children with arthritis, heart disease, and autoimmune conditions than any other country in the world per population. What have you been able to do with those conditions?
But Dr. Null, you and I are old enough to know that wasn't always the case. You know, 30 years ago, they had virtually no obesity, no type 2 diabetes, no rheumatoid arthritis, no MS in China, Japan, Thailand, et cetera. But in the last 35 years, actually, since 1980, wealth has come to both China and India. Now China reports that 12% of their population is diabetic and half are pre-diabetic. And in India, they just told us 2 years ago, the health of the middle class has now become as poor as the health of the upper class in terms of obesity, type 2 diabetes. It's only the really poor class of people in India that still retain trimness and good health because they can't afford to eat all the meat and dairy and oil, et cetera, that the middle class now can in India. So what you and I know to be true, Dr. Null, from our years of experience, isn't true anymore. You know, because of CNN and because of Internet and everything, everybody knows about eating at Burger King and Dairy Queen, and et cetera. We all know how to eat like kings and queens, and because of the wealth of this world, most people can't afford to, and over half the population does suffer from diseases. We're talking about the world. Half the world's population does suffer from dietary diseases of too much food, too much of the wrong kind of food, period.
Well, that the United States is certainly the great provocateur and educator, propagandizing.
We started it, but the Chinese and the Indians and the Japanese, et cetera, they're really fast learners.
That's unfortunate. I want to thank you for the good work you're doing out there, and I look forward to an extended conversation that we'll be having in the near future. We'll look forward to filming you for our upcoming special.
I've been available before. I've loved being with you, Gary, and I look forward to the next time we can be together.
Thank you. Dr. John McDougall, McDougall. The website is drmcdougall.com. I'm Gary Null. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone. We'll be right back.